You're listening to We Are SDS. It's a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 15. Each year, we select one book that we ask all students and staff to read and discuss. It's the STS One Book Program. The idea is to bring together our whole community into one sustained conversation about a topic we all can contribute to. We've been going with this for nearly 20 years now, and we've covered an enormous distance. For the last academic year, the STS One Book was Gemma Milne's Smoke and Mirrors. Now, I'm sure you remember I spoke with Gemma about it in an earlier podcast. Well, in May this year, with the academic year coming to its conclusion, we invited Gemma back in to talk with one of our experts in science and technology policy, Professor Jack Stilgo. Their conversation took place in front of a live audience at our STS One Book celebration. It was great to see Gemma and Jack together, and it was great to see everybody else, all the staff and students there together too. Oh, it's just so good to hear live audiences again. We pick up the recording with Jack introducing the event.
Okay, let's make a start. First thing, thank you all for coming. First thing, admin-wise, is that we're planning to record the conversation between Gemma and me so that we can put it out in a podcast. We won't be recording questions, but I am very keen to have questions. So what we'll probably do is half an hour of conversation. Does that sound about right, Gemma?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've got half an hour of...
Sure. I would hope so.
Okay, good. So we'll do about half an hour and then we'll open it up to questions from anybody. The aim is to be done within an hour so that there's plenty of time to just hang out afterwards. We've got this room for 2 hours. I've just noticed that like half of the clocks at UCL, that one is four and a bit hours off. So that's... I won't try not to be looking at that one. So let's get stuck into it. So the aim, let me just, a bit of background about the One Book. The One Book is a program that we've been running for years here at UCL STS. The idea is by getting everybody to read one book together, we can all learn something and we can all discuss around one object. And this year's One Book is this. Smoke and Mirrors by Gemma Milne. And Gemma is a wonderful science writer, science talker, presenter, all-round superstar, who also conveniently is a PhD researcher in STS. And you can find Gemma's work, you know, in The Times, The Guardian, all over YouTube, all over social media. Sorry, Gemma, a bit embarrassing.
Not quite,
but
all over. Just
no.
Just here and there.
In that corner of social media. And what we're going to talk about today is, well, I want to get a bit of a sense of the background of the book. I want to know a bit about, you know, why this issue bugged you enough to write a book about it when you started. I want to know, you know, what the big idea of the book is, but also I want to know what, if you were to write it today, you would add in. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the interesting things about writing anything to do with contemporary science, and in particular, visions of the future in contemporary science, is how quickly they date. So let me start off then by taking you back to when your coming up with the idea for the book, when you're pitching the book, what was the, you know, what was bugging you? What was the thing that you wanted to address with this?
To be honest, I was getting asked by an agent that I was working with to write a book about cool new tech, and that annoyed me. And being a writer in the science and tech space, not only are you reading stuff that, you know, you kind of help by going, oh, I could have done that better, or it frustrates you seeing certain headlines, but I'm also receiving pitches into my inbox from various different, particularly startups or researchers or whoever, who are wanting to get their ideas heard by me. So hype and particularly headlines and narratives was something that I was bugged about personally, and I was particularly annoyed when someone was like, you should write a book about the 10 coolest new technologies out there. And I was like, I wouldn't be seen dead writing that book, because that would discredit my whole skeptical thinking thing that,
yes,
I like
indeed
to do.
Yeah.
So originally I wanted to do something that was sort of hype busting, but not just, oh, don't look at this tech, look at this one instead. And it kind of evolved from being a, I don't want to say an anti-hype book, but evolved from being a hype is bad and we need to wrestle with it better, to being like, actually, this is a quite interesting phenomenon and tool and whatever, and we can go into that a bit deeper, that I think is worth exploring in its own right, as opposed to looking at the tech itself or the science itself. So it was certainly coming from a place of frustration, both as a reader of science and tech and as someone who was just faced with hype. But I mean, going back, I've worked in jobs to do with hype. I worked in advertising industry. That was my first kind of, well, my second kind of big job out of uni. The first one was investment banking, which is also a very hypey and immoral space, along with advertising. And, you know, so I was working in spaces where you were creating hype for particular reasons.
And did you know you were doing that in those jobs?
I didn't in banking, but then I was just, you know, an Excel monkey, so I wasn't really fully aware of what I was doing. In advertising, not to begin with, but over time, I started getting quite frustrated because I got moved into the innovation team. My job was to find cool new startups, and I would get people from, you know, the different accounts, so say someone who worked on the Amex account or someone who worked on the Danone account or whatever, and they'd come to me and they say, oh, my client wants to do an innovative ads campaign. What can you do? And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, can you get us like a cool startup who can feature in the ad? And it was so frustrating. I was like, that isn't the point of science. And, you know, coming from a science background, I was known as like the science nerd in the agency. And irked me. I felt like people were like using science. I felt very defensive of science.
So I think I want to come back to that. The role of science versus, you know, something that we might call tech or entrepreneurialism or innovation, and how those things. Just before I get to that, I want to ask you, did you feel that, you know, at the time that you started, did you feel that there was something new happening? Because, you know, one response would be, well, it has ever been thus, right?
Yeah.
Hypey people, entrepreneurs, innovators have always, you know, come up with their particular vision of the future and then tried to sell it to you on the grounds that it's inevitable. But what is it about the time, what is it about now that makes you think this it's different?
I think it was the sort of entertainment value of hype, and particularly in the startup space. You know, I'm sure everyone here has gone to an academic conference. I don't know if you've gone to like a tech startup conference. They are not the same. Like a tech startup conference is like entertainment, it's like theater, tons of money goes into like how incredible it looks, and then you've got these startups coming on stage for 5 minutes to sell their idea, and then they get like $1 million, and there's like a lot of this kind of at the time, it's less so now, heroism and excitement around this very idea of being a startup founder, which is different seemingly than someone who leads an SME. You know, startup has this like very specific idea around it. So when I was pitching this, it felt sort of almost at the end of that peak, this, you know, hackathons with pizzas and elevator pitches literally in an elevator, and things like that. So I don't know, and I, you know, rode that. I enjoyed working in that space. It was fun to get to go to these conferences, but you do after a while are like, this is ridiculous. Why are we giving $1 million to this person who's really good at doing a 5-minute PowerPoint.
So that sort of sense that you're in a bubble.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Hugely.
And that nobody is brave enough to prick that bubble.
Every now and you would. Well, that was the thing. It was also entertaining to be the critic. If you could do a really good PowerPoint slide that was saying, "No, don't listen to any of this," then you were the cool next new thing in this space. And so I think it was the sort of theatrical element of the startup Silicon Valley thing, and all this thing of like, how can we be more Silicon Valley? Mm. There was lots of discussions in London about, you know, Silicon Roundabout, how can we be the Silicon Valley?
Yeah, remember
Valley?
That?
Yeah, exactly.
That's people who don't remember that, but it was Old Street Roundabout.
Old Street Roundabout.
Which remains Old Street Roundabout, and actually all big tech.
Yes.
Has actually ended up in King's Cross. Which
well, yeah. And, but then it's like, what do you count as like startups versus SMEs? This is something I find really interesting. If you want to look at like the companies that are actually making any money or doing things that actually impact global systems, they probably call themselves an SME or just a company or business or like something limited, you know, whereas startups is they're startups, you know, they're all about being a unicorn or 10 times growth, and it's and very digital focused. So I think it's that sort of difference in culture and that difference in vibe that I was starting to feel. I started covering what was called, I think still called now, deep tech. At the time I was shifting into covering that more so than more digital tech. So I was covering actual science. And I think that as well was a real, you know, you can't go into a meeting with a company that's, you know, literally trying to change the cables that you put electricity through. And then the next one you're looking at like Instagram for hamsters and they've got like a higher valuation and you're like, what is this? This is not right. So I think it was that sort of reckoning myself and realizing my own role in all of this, being a writer, someone who's covering it, someone's going to these conferences, speaking at these conferences. You know, there was an element of guilt, I think. I felt like if I wrote a book about it, maybe it would make me feel better.
So, I mean, it is a critical book and you've already sort of define some of the critique there, but you've also said that you're sort of, well, firstly, you're sympathetic to why some of these people, some of these SMEs might have to hype or feel the need to hype. And are there good things about hype? Is it sort of functionally necessary or is it?
Well, I mean, you hear a lot nowadays about so-called attention economy, right? And I think you see, in academia, you, in order for your work to be published, to get funding, to get onto a PhD program, to, you know, even get your conference paper accepted, you need to find a way of talking about what you do in a particular way that may or not be related to the actual crux of the work. So there's a role for the tool of grabbing attention that is how I think of hype. You know, and a lot of what the book focuses on is like, you know, essentially, do you think the ends justify the means, really? And obviously, that's a very personal question, and it's what we all debate in politics every day, right? So, and I think that's what I wanted to kind of dive into, because if you go, you know, to a very hypey, startup-y conference that's quite insular and in a bubble, there's an element of kind of groupthink around what's deemed acceptable hype. So like, yeah, it's okay to exaggerate what your startup's doing because you need to get funding. Whereas if you were an outsider looking in, you go, well, that doesn't really seem right. You know, some people defended Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes for a long time because they were like, well, you got to fake it till you make it. You got to get funding. You got to do this, that and the other. And I don't agree with that, by the way. But,
no, but there is that sort of don't hate the player, hate the game type
exactly.
thing. That's the justification
exactly.
that they would use.
Yeah, yeah. And that was another thing that I found very difficult with that world, because I suppose I was having my own awakening in the sense that I was like, is this whole idea of like startups even a good idea, you know? And so suddenly this idea of it being good to be an entrepreneur and worthy to be an innovator and, you know, you're a better person if you're in the world of science and tech. You know, I was questioning that as well. And I think, so it's these sorts of, I guess, ideas and cultural attachments to things that happen within science and tech that I think define whether or not you believe the hype is justified
yeah.
or not.
So is there any way that we can, you know, look at what people are saying and which we might label hype and say that's sort of good hype, that's bad hype, that's somehow divorced from reality?
Well, I think if you're lying, it's definitely not right. And I think you know, and that's where, you know, people say, bring up Theranos a lot when I'm talking about the book. And I thought I'd mentioned it as a thing that I wasn't going to talk about, although maybe I've just done that in talks afterwards, because I don't count what they did as hype. I count what they did as lying.
Because out and they out were fraud.
Yeah, well, they knew that it didn't work and they said it did, right? So there's a lie there. There's a quite definitive, you know? Like, I wouldn't say it's... how I think there's a difference, how I think you can differentiate is whether or not you're saying this is... You're clear on whether this is something you're working towards, this is a vision, or this is the reality of what currently is happening. And yes, it makes a much more boring headline or tagline for your startup if you say, we are doing this in the future, as opposed to we are doing this, you know, full stop. But the point being is I think that's if you're sort of arguably deliberately muddying the waters, I think there's a level of understanding that you're utilising a tool that's going to fool people for your benefit.
I just wonder, because, you know, I'm thinking of the idols of current SMEs, which would include Elon Musk, but also Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs used to, you know, have this idea of the reality distortion field around him, which is like, you know, actually what's true, what's right now doesn't really matter because I'm in the business of making the future. So yeah. I won't be constrained by current circumstances or limits that others impose upon
me. And some people say that about Elon Musk. And also they say, well, Elon Musk is great, so he should be allowed to do that because it's worth him getting the, you know, permission or the money or the power or whatever to make our world a better place. And I definitely disagree with that, but, you know, you could argue that that's the same as voting in a particular kind of politician or so on and so forth. It's like the belief on who you think should have power. I do think, though, when it comes to here's an example. So company, for instance, which builds satellites, and they say our company is all about bringing internet to corners of the globe that aren't currently connected, connecting the unconnected. You know, this is like a really common thing in the sort of satellite world. And they get to call themselves a social enterprise. They can enter funding rounds that are about, you know, yeah, social good and so on and so forth. Because at the end of the day, ultimately, what they are working towards, or they say they are doing, is bringing internet to the people who don't have it. Now, in order to get technology cheap enough, scaled up enough into particular areas, from nothing into something, you're probably going to have to do a different kind of business to make the money. And a lot of satellite companies, in order to build their technology, expand and so on and so forth, have a business first and something else. And in the satellite business, it tends to be military or oil and gas, because you're helping oil and gas companies with their ships in remote areas. So is it fair to say, oh, we're bringing internet to the unconnected and so on and so forth, but currently we're, you know, selling to the military? I would say that's completely not right, and that is hyped and wrong to say that. However, if you can, and I think enough people within the startup world, the business world, understand that you have to do certain things as a business in order to get to the point you want to be. Again, up to you whether you think that's right or wrong.
So is it?
But it's about being clear about it.
So, I mean, that example makes me think of Facebook, who, you know, tell the world that what they're in the business of is connecting people. They don't say we're the world's largest advertising company.
Right.
Do you think they should? I take it that you think they should say that, but is it a big problem that
I mean
don't we all basically know that?
I was going to say, yeah, I think it's different depending on who it is you're trying to convince with that idea, right? Like with the satellite company, you know, and you see this with particularly in energy, you see companies applying for social enterprise funding and they get social enterprise funding, and for me that's wrong. I'm kind of like, you shouldn't be allowed to get this segmented funding. If currently your business model does X and in service of Y, that should be enough to get you there. If that's your route of choice, so be it. Or you go and get social enterprise funding. It's one or the other. With something like Facebook, yeah, I would argue that people kind of already know that, but that's now. I mean, back in the day.
Absolutely. There's a lot that we know about Facebook now that we didn't realise when we had a chance to do something about it.
And there's also the question of, you know, at what point did it become an advertising company versus, you know, it started out as like a rating woman company, didn't it? And it was obviously that, right? So, you know, I don't think Mark Zuckerberg was sitting there going, oh, I'm going to make an advertising company. I think he was thinking, I can make a ratings company, or I can make a university connection company, and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's also an argument sometimes people make, is like, well, you know, when did it become bad? Or like, who's responsible for the point that it turned over? And people like, companies like Facebook, you do have someone who has ultimate control rights. You can lay blame very easily, but with a lot of companies, that's not the case. You have multiple different steps made at various different points of the process, and you can kind of not really get that source of blame. So it's a rubbish answer, as no, it depends.
I want to come to blame in a second and sort of say, if we do think hype's a problem, you know, where is it a problem, and who do we think is responsible? Just before we get to that, just talk us through some of the examples that, because you have, you know, 8 or 10 chapters where you look at individual debates happening around one particular area of technology or one particular area of industry. Which, you know, having done the research for the book, which of those examples do you think were particularly revealing, or do you think we're not talking about enough?
I mean, it was 2 years ago, so I think things have evolved a little bit. I mean, like, for instance, Fusion, I wrote a chapter on Fusion, and I think when it came out, that was quite surprising to a lot of people, and even learned people didn't really know anything about Fusion. I think it's a bit different now. There's been a lot of investment in that space, and there's a bit more of a public conversation. Maybe I just follow Fusion journalists on Twitter. But
well, there were some results that came out a few months ago,
yeah,
weren't there?
Yeah, that's right.
Hooray! Our fusion experiment has finally succeeded in generating just a bit less energy than it took to start the experiment in the first place.
That's
and
right.
Everybody
but
was
that's
sort
a
of
big
happy
deal.
About that.
But that's a big deal. And okay, so like, let's talk about fusion. I think we're talking about fusion now. Like, the argument that I make in the fusion chapter is that it ends up being so poorly misunderstood, the butt of jokes, that in some ways it's actually underhyped. And that is a problem for the development of this technology, not to hype up the technology and say, I think it's amazing. However, I do think that there's the power of hype in this space is that it slows development or is detrimental to development in a fusion space. So the sort of history of fusion as a technology is that, you know, it was thought of as pseudoscience for a long time. There literally were fraudsters saying they were creating fusion when they weren't. There was reputable scientists saying that they could do cold fusion when they couldn't. And a lot of then confusion around what was real and what wasn't around fusion. So there's a lot of valid history around failure and confusion and pseudoscience associated with this word fusion. There's also been experiments that were hyped up in history, and again, I touch on them in the chapter. You know, we are going to create unlimited energy, and you know, it was a way of explaining to the public why this big investment in this public piece of science experimentation essentially was useful. We're going to create unlimited energy. So of course, all the journalists come and say, great, you're going to be able to like create a machine that means we don't have to pay for electricity anymore, and so on and so forth. And of course, you go and they do the experiment. The experiment's a success because we're getting closer and closer to that point. But of course, you're getting the public going, okay, cool, so do we have like free electricity yet? And it's like, well, obviously not. And so it's seen as a failure.
Yeah, yeah.
So this idea that fusion is always 50 years away is this repeated joke that I said in the book. And hilariously, when we were on that BBC Three, do you remember we were getting interviewed on BBC Radio Three?
Yes, indeed, yes.
And Matthew Sweet said it. He was like, oh, fusion, isn't that always 50 years away? I was like, exactly, this is this joke that everyone makes. I didn't even tell you to say it. So it's still repeated over and over again, this fusion is 50 years away.
That suggests a victory for counter-hype, doesn't it? If we have a successful narrative about nuclear fusion hype.
Yes, yeah, well, I guess so. I think it's just that, for me, I find it really interesting that this, literally this little quip, this little like dinner party joke seems to have like captured the conversation around fusion. And so that's one example that I kind of use in the book, and I go through kind of the history of it in terms of these experiments, but also the kind of really quite fascinating bureaucracy around how various different governments have tried to come together to make fusion happen, and again pulling out funding because they don't have public support, because again the public either think it's pseudoscience, or they confuse it with fission, think it's nuclear waste, or think it's 50 years away and not worth investing in. So that's one example that I think is kind of fun. But I put it in the book because I knew that there was a few kind of big things happening with over the next few years, and I have hopes if people read it, they'd then be able to follow the news along with it, you know, the article. That
you and as you
read.
Say, I mean, one of the telling things about fusion is that there isn't much industrial investment in it, which sort of tells you something about the nature of the hype around that technology, as opposed to another of your examples, AI, right, where the last, I mean, you know, if we know what it is, people aren't necessarily investing in the same thing. But the story, the hype about AI has seen billions, if not trillions, invested.
Crazy.
In it. I mean, what's your sense of the sort of the promise and the perils, not with AI, but with the hype about AI?
Well, I mean, it's that idea of we're going to get another AI winter, or we're going to disappoint people. I think, though, that we've kind of, that's already sort of happened, but there's so much discussion about it. Everyone's at a different stage, if that makes sense. So I feel like you've got some people who are still at the stage of like, AI is going to solve everything in the general public. But you've also got people in the general public who understand that that's hype. And I think that's, you don't have that with many technologies where it's sort of gone through so many cycles where you actually end up having enough critique as well as positivity for people that don't do anything to do with the technology at all. Where I think the issue around hype and AI is that it is so muddied. It's like, so what actually is happening right now? Nobody really seems to know, right? Even, you know, at that Alan Turing Institute event a couple of months ago. And even then it was like, what's the latest thing we should talk about? And what's the latest discovery that's... Yeah. And there was a lot of debate there. So I think it's the fact that it's actually muddied the waters in some way, and yet you still have a lot of dominant... You have dominant narrative of AI is going to save the world, and then you also have a dominant narrative of AI is not.
Yes.
And so you're just left with this kind of...
I had my own morning encounter with AI hype. This morning I desperately needed to buy an electric toothbrush. So I went on Amazon, I'm afraid, and bought an electric toothbrush. The one that I didn't buy, because it was too expensive, was an Oral-B artificial intelligence toothbrush.
Would you have bought it if it wasn't more expensive?
Maybe for... I might have found it for research purposes,
yeah. You know, to...
Absolutely. But if it would sell my oral data to the world, then I might have concerns about that.
But then some people probably wouldn't. Yeah, exactly. That's what's interesting. You would have people buying it because they think it's cool, and other people buying it because they're worried by it.
Yeah. And a whole lot of people, as you say, who would just look at that and say, seriously?
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I don't know. I find AI a kind of difficult one to sort of come up with an answer to at the moment. And that was kind of... what I tried to think about, because when I was writing the AI chapter, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm just putting this in this book because everyone's going to expect an AI chapter at the time. That was the obvious hype thing to have.
Yeah.
And so I suppose I tried to write it and go, the fact that it's so hypey means we're actually not talking about it at all. And what I meant by that was we're getting distracted by various different kinds of hypey conversations, either AI is going to save the world, AI is going to kill us, robots are going to steal our jobs, the Terminator's coming, and we're not actually talking about power, we're not actually talking about decisions being made, and the reality, the fact that this technology is being developed and is being invested in right now. We're kind of caught up in philosophical conversations. Not that those aren't important, those are important.
So let me ask you then, and because you mentioned, you know, the Turing Institute, which has a lot of university scientists involved, you've talked about reality and, you know, distortions and lies. And, you know, ultimately, we'd like to be able to hold on to something scientific so that we can say, you know, what's actually happening. Mm. And I think this raises some questions about what scientists should do in this sort of area. So what do you think is the role of, you know, not the Elon Musks of this world, but a boring university scientist who might find themselves involved in one of these hypey sort of areas, like a lot of computer scientists have around AI and, or, you know, if you're working on a nuclear fusion experiment?
I think, I don't want to say it depends, it's such a boring answer, but I think
it's the correct answer. Well, that's what we tell all our students.
I mean, I don't know. It's a difficult one. I think it depends on what your career aspirations are as a scientist. And what I mean by that is, are you trying to become somebody who essentially does basic, and not simple, but basic science experiments? You're there to, you know, literally try and move the intricacies of a technology forward, really specific. Are you a kind of more career academic where you want to be, I don't know, writing books and out in the public and commenting on Guardian articles and so on and so forth? More like you, Jack, I don't mean that in a bad way, but like, you know, that sort of more outward person who's willing to try and kind of make things obvious to people as well as do research? Or are you trying to kind of be more of a policy person? You know, I think it depends on what it is you're trying to achieve alongside your research. And with that comes different kinds of responsibilities in terms of what you do. So if you're that person who's more in the lab, I think it's about process. It's like, how are you embedding questions around society, ethics, responsibility, so on and so forth in your day-to-day work, as opposed to going, this isn't my job, I just run some experiments. Right. It's like, actually, what does hiring practices look like? What are the issues around who's in your team? How do you, you know, define what's true and false in your area, so on and so forth? If you're public, it's like, how do you balance simplifying things versus making sure people listen? If you're a policy person, how do you ensure, you know, you're putting across the best information possible, it's not politically biased as much as you can, and so on and so forth. Like, there's different types of responsibility in each place. And so for me, it's about being aware of the cascading effect of what you're doing ultimately on development, as opposed to trying to do it all at once, trying to say, oh, I'll make sure I don't write a grant that's hypey, and I'll also make sure I do ethics, and I'll also make sure, because I mean, like, let's be honest, you're not going to be able to do all those things.
And that's quite interesting, so you're not saying that, you know, the role of the scientist is to say, no, let's stick to the facts, I'm not going to talk about...
Well, we're in STS, what are facts? You know, like, it's true, like, you can't... What do we mean by stick to the facts, right? And I think that's kind of... That's the point that we're always trying to unpick in STS. It's like, it's being aware of your position and being aware of where you come from as a person, but also where you're coming from what you've read and where your academic history comes from or your work history and so on and so forth, and letting that inform and be present in what you put out, as opposed to focusing on the science, whatever you deem that is, and pushing aside everything else. So I think it's about not being siloed or not seeing yourself as a siloed individual, but rather pulling in on our things, you know, being a human. Like, I don't, scientists are not special. Nobody is special.
So one thing that, I mean, when you say to scientists, you know, that, oh, maybe their study or their area of research is getting hyped, one of their responses often is to say, oh, well, that's the media's fault, it's not science's fault. And, you know, that might even be Elon Musk's response as well, when you say your self-driving cars don't work, he might say, oh, well, people just aren't reading the small print, or, you know, people don't understand what my engineers stand. I mean, do you have a sense of where responsibility tends to fall around hype, and then where it should fall if we were going to make good decisions?
I think the first thing that everybody has to do is to acknowledge hype. I think that's what doesn't happen so often. It's this idea, like, you know, so, like, take quantum computing as an example. That is an area that was not getting enough attention, and then a lot of advocacy work was done by scientists, specifically because there weren't really companies in quantum, but specifically by scientists, by institutions and so on and so forth, to make people care about it more, to make the public understand it more. And then it kind of went over this hill where it's like, oh, now we need to kind of pull it back, it's actually not that great, and so on and so forth. And so if you said to a quantum computing scientist, oh, it's super hyping, oh, it's the media's fault, it's like, well, you have to accept that you personally might not have written a press release, but the scientists and scientific institutions that were funding this research, has probably funded your research, did do part of that work, and it was deliberate. Not in a, like, conspiracy theory way, but it was a strategy to try and get more people interested in it and then fund it. And quantum computing benefited from it in many ways as a collective. So you can look at many different areas of hype, and I think it's about people understanding how that hype came to be. And it's not, you don't have to go and read a book. You can read my book if you like. You don't have to read a book. It's quite simple, really. And I think that kind of resistance to like who's done it or whose fault it is not really helpful. It's like, well, actually, well,
it's quite simple if we look at scientists as people with interests who have, you know, questions that they want to answer, and, you know, they want to get resources and attention and all the rest of it. But this goes to my question about what's different about hype when it comes to science rather than just, you know, somebody trying to sell me a toothbrush, which is that often when we look at scientists, we think that person knows what they're talking about, and they don't. Mm. You know, we don't just see that person has, you know, interests and they want money, right? Yeah. We would like to think that they have other sort of commitments.
Yeah.
Is that part of the issue?
I mean, then the scientists would say it's not our fault the public love us. You know, like, I think that it's not a zero-sum game to say we have to focus on one or the other, right? Like, I think we have to, it's not just about being aware of hype around the science and tech, but rather the very idea of science as a whole. You know, this was something in the pandemic that came up time and time again, especially with preprints. Remember the famous FT example where they wrote this big article that was based on a preprint and then it informed like the next day's policy meeting, because of course decisions were being made so soon. And then a couple of days later, a big, you know, not a retraction, but a question around this preprint was posted by a whole load of scientists saying actually the methods weren't so great. It's a good paper, nothing wrong with it, but this is our response. And, you know, people who have an understanding of science and publishing know that that's how it works. You put a preprint out and then people comment on it and then it's updated and then new science is done and so on and so forth. But when you're putting that out in the media and then there's decisions being made on it, that's seen as a detriment. Like, oh my God, we should not have preprints. That's really dangerous. And so then there was this question of like, you know, what do we do about that in science communication? Is it about trying to get people to understand preprints? Is it trying to get people to understand the science? Is it trying to get people to talk about trust? And I'm like, well, it's all of those. We shouldn't just do one of them. And it's the same when you're thinking about, you know, how do we tackle hype? Or how, it's like, well, we should talk about hype as a concept, but we should also be talking about the hype around particular things. There's enough of us to be, we've got enough room in our brains and we've got enough people to be writing about things. And, you know, as a writer, I don't think it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff about being a science writer, you know, what's your beat or what you cover. And, you know, I don't really like to say that I cover a particular area of science and tech, because then it kind
of... Your beat is the future, Gemma.
Yes. So cool. Oh God, please no. But yeah, I feel that that can then stop you from being able to actually properly dispel hype, or rather... what I think is how you do dispel hype is you talk about a system as opposed to the thing itself. So whereas if you're like, well, I cover batteries, then you're never going to write about new battery technology. You're not going to write about, well, if you're good, you'll write about supply chains and batteries and so on and so forth. So I've forgotten what your question was, so sorry about that. But it was a very roundabout way of saying I don't think we should try and work out what's the specific message we have to sort of say to people or what scientists have to do to dispel hype, but rather think about what are the various different things that we have dominant preconceived hyped up ideas about with regard to science and tech. And there are many of those actually have nothing to do with science and tech itself. Science is hard is one. Scientists can only be white men is another. You know, science is really expensive. It's arguably true. But, you know, the point is that I think there's a lot of different ideas and narratives that are hyped up that require a systemic exploration that is not just the media's responsibility, though partly it's everyone that works in the space that talks about it.
So final question. One of the things that I imagine you get quite a lot, because, you know, it's a critique of hype, and a lot of the people that you're critiquing would regard some sort of hype as necessary. I imagine a lot of the response is something like, oh, well, you know, that sounds quite Luddite, it sounds quite reactionary. Progress has to happen. Like, you know, what is the response to that sort of?
Funnily
critique?
Enough, my space chapter, I sent all my chapters to people in the industry to make sure they felt it was true. And of all the chapters, the space one was the one that people came back, it was like, you're so negative. And I was like, the chapter is literally about getting rid of rose-tinted glasses. Like, I'm glad that it's making you feel like that. That's what it's meant to do.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Which, do you think they were a bit sort of nervous? Does that come from a sort of sense of insecurity?
I think they were nervous. I think they were angry at me. Because I'd like interviewed them, and I think they felt that I was beating down on their industry when I was like, did you read the chapter? Like, I'm not beating down on it. I'm just saying we've got the wrong idea about it. And you know that to be true because that's what you told me. But I know the illusion is helpful for these people, right? So particularly in space.
Plus they've had a story, you know,
yeah,
50 years of
a and, I mean, it's pretty cool, big story. It's cool to work in space, you know, like, yeah. Let's like, you know, if you're a nerd and you work in space, like that, yes, pretty cool nerd, aren't you? Like anyone you meet, you'd say, oh, I'm a rocket scientist. You know, it doesn't matter if they understand what you do or not, that's cool. So, you know, anyone that's coming around saying, actually, space isn't that cool, it's really just satellite companies. You know, you're kind of ruining a nice illusion. What was your original question?
So I wanted to know,
what's my response?
Yeah,
to people
when
saying,
people like that say, well, you're so negative.
Well, first of all, you said the word Luddite. Anyone who's a historian of technology here, which I know there are many, will know that the Luddites were not anti-technology. They
Thank were
actually
you very
pro-technology.
Yes. Citation
they were
needed.
Good technology. I don't have a citation off the top of my head. I'm sorry. Anyone in the room would like to add?
We'll find that later.
And funnily enough, I think last year, 2021, there was like two or three books all came out about like the trying to be a resurgence of Ludditism. Like, what does modern Ludditism look like? And it's, you know, we want technology, but we don't want it to be bad, basically. So I would say that if anyone used the word Luddite. But I don't know. I think the response is that, there's two responses. If you want to talk about it in terms of making the world a better place, I think being a critic of science and technology is useful to make the world a better place. You know, I think that you can be overly optimistic about the future, which is actually a pessimistic position. What I mean by that is if you're thinking, oh, you know, isn't it amazing that we're going to have this AI and so on and so forth? Doesn't that mean you think the world right now is terrible? You know, there just seems something kind of like actually really negative about that. And I think being a critic is ultimately an optimistic position. Like, you're wanting things to be better because you believe they can be better.
And you mentioned that, you know, you regard some things as drastically underhyped.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Right? And you know, I think with more people discussing and engaging with these topics, I mean, I don't think that the science is bad. I don't think cancer therapeutics are bad, obviously. I would hope that would be obvious, but I think sometimes people think that tech critics and science critics think that the science is bad. And it's like, you don't think it's bad. You think how it's being used or who's controlling it or the development issues or whatever could be better. So that's one thing. But the other argument that I kind of give to people that maybe don't work in the space is that thinking about science and tech through a critical lens makes it way more interesting than looking at it through this, like, you know, isn't science awesome way. You when you really look at a system and you like unpick things and you see what all the open questions are and what we're not able to do yet, what we find difficult, what's like the normative arguments around it, I believe it makes it way more fascinating, way more fascinating. And that's why I put the astrobiology chapter in there. And a lot of people have been like, why are you putting aliens in a book about hype? And I'm like, that's why, because you're asking the question. And, you know, when you start asking these kind of questions, you just start allowing yourself to not just take this isn't it awesome narrative for granted. I think it just opens up stuff in a far more fascinating way. And ultimately, I am in science and tech because I was awed by science and tech as a child, you know. I was the person looking up at the stars and thinking they were amazing. But I also thought when someone started unpicking it, I was like, oh, I feel like let down by this. But then I was like, oh, that's a weird emotion. Maybe I should try and explore that a little bit more. And then suddenly you see the awe again, and then you hate it again, and then you see the awe, and then you don't. And I think that's a far more fun way to engage with science and tech than to just be like,
isn't it great? More imaginative, which is what I think is so interesting about the critique that you're mounting here. Thank you very much, Gemma. Can you just all join me in thanking Gemma Milne for joining us?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you.
very special thanks to Gemma Milne for coming along, and thanks too for Jack Stilgo for his work as the interviewer. Both Gemma and Jack have podcasts of their own, and I've put links to these in the show notes if you want to hear more. Both are strongly recommended, not only if you're into tech policy or science communication, but also if you want to know more about STS and what we do generally. Also, I want to thank our recording engineer, Yui Zhu, one of our first-year students in STS. Very quickly, she mastered the kit, and I think you'll agree she did a great job recording this session. Now, if you're an STS student and you want to volunteer to help with the podcast, just get in touch. We've got a variety of options available for you. Music today featured Roland at 5 by Kevin MacLeod. That's available online at filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Thanks for coming along today. We'll have another episode ready soon. In fact, we have more student projects in the works right now. Oh, very exciting! They'll be coming to you later this summer. Until next time, everybody, the one thing to remember is that together we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS. It's a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.